Hey, hon, what do you say we do lobsters tonight?
Dial 911. It's the lobster squad.
Talk to him. You speak shellfish.
Annie, there's a big lobster behind the refrigerator. I can't get it out.
People think of lobsters as a pricey delicacy, and as Woody Allen proved, they're naturally funny. But people aren't ordering lobsters these days, even though they are more abundant than ever. A prickly economic indicator declawed on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, November 12th, and look out, John. There's a big lobster right behind you.
Ah! Land shark.
Good morning. We're going to be talking about the economy and how it's changing quickly. Also, the bailout plan and Thanksgiving. Believe it or not, it's not too early to start planning and preparing that meal. Those stories coming up, but first we have some headlines.
All kinds of bailout talk in Washington today for automakers and homeowners. Cars first. Top Democrats in Congress say they'll push for emergency legislation to let Detroit car companies tap into the Treasury Department's $700 billion bailout fund. This sets the stage for a battle, potentially, between President Bush and the Congress to keep that money restricted to financial institutions. Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson will tell us how his rescue plan is going at a news conference later this morning. And as for housing, a new government plan promises to help struggling homeowners with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac mortgages.
The program targets the highest risk borrowers who have missed three payments or more, own or occupy their property, and have not filed for bankruptcy.
James Lockhart, a federal housing official, says hundreds of thousands of homes could qualify for adjustments, but some say the plan doesn't go far enough, including the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation chief.
President-elect Barack Obama inherits all of these problems, and he's just added two big names to his transition team. Former Georgia Senator Sam Nunn will advise him on Pentagon issues. Former Secretary of State Warren Christopher will advise him on State Department issues. And as for Republican Senator John McCain, he says he has no regrets on his running mate choice.
I couldn't be happier with Sarah Palin, and she's going back to be a great governor, and I think she will play a big role in the future of this country.
That was McCain talking to Jay Leno last night on NBC. It was his first post-election interview. He said he looks forward to going back to the Senate, and he will not run for president in 2012.
I understand he's going to be made a permanent host of Saturday Night Live. McCain will actually be back on the campaign trail this week. He'll be in Georgia, where Republican Saxby Chambliss would like his help in a runoff race there. He faces Democrat Jim Martin, who's getting aid from the Obama campaign. Along with Minnesota and Alaska, it's one of three Senate seats where the winner is still unknown.
Oil prices are sliding. They hit around $58 a barrel today. European markets are up just a touch. Asian markets dipped, though not too badly. Wall Street futures basically point to a flat opening.
So everybody's talking about the auto industry bailout. What do you have to say about it? Are you out of the loop? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Do you think the auto industry should be bailed out? Is the pain in Detroit Detroit's own problem? What do you think?
877-8, my take or my take at thetakeaway.org. Should they get a penny or much more than that?
Bailout Detroit or bailout Adora? She used to live near Detroit.
Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hello. Good morning.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We begin with the economy, as has been the case for most mornings these last several weeks. And joining us now is Chrystia Freeland, who's U.S. Managing Editor for the Financial Times. Chrystia, thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning.
With the story about Amex yesterday, American Express, getting into the bank holding company business and thereby being eligible for bailout money from the Federal Treasury, including actually a place at the discount window at the Federal Reserve. It appears that the federal government is suddenly a full-service bank, stretching from complicated commercial paper all the way down to consumer credit cards. Is the federal government the sole owner of the U.S. economy at this point?
Well, the thing is, with Amex, the decision to become a bank holding company, it hasn't actually participated in the program where the federal government took equity stakes in the big banks. That's something a little bit different. But what we have seen is, you know, historically, institutions which weren't retail banks actually didn't want to be bank holding companies because along with the access to increased borrowing from the Federal Reserve, which is so precious to them right now, come much more onerous regulatory requirements. They have to submit to a lot more regulation and greater capital requirements. So in the past, companies like Amex, but also like Goldman Sachs, like Morgan Stanley, they didn't want to be bank holding companies. That was the last thing they wanted. What we're seeing now is everyone essentially running under the skirts of the Federal Reserve. Amex is the latest one to do that. GMAC, which is the financing arm of General Motors, has also applied for it. And there aren't really that many financial institutions left which haven't essentially surrendered and said, you know what, we're going to have to be boring bank holding companies and be more regulated, have greater capital requirements, but also have access to this additional liquidity from the Fed.
Well, let's talk about the boring part for a moment and the regulatory part. Is there any evidence that GMAC, that American Express, that even Goldman Sachs have actually done what is necessary to become a bank holding company, to disclose to the federal government the kinds of information that normally they wouldn't have to, or actually put up the kinds of reserves that they need to guarantee their depositors?
Well, you actually probably wouldn't want them to have to raise their reserves right away. If the Fed were to do that with these new bank holding companies, then you would have an even more intense liquidity crunch in the system. So actually what you want is for that process to be a slower one. But there is a big question now on what some of the actual universal banks have been around for a while are wondering is how much time is the Fed going to give these new bank holding companies, not so much Amex, but companies like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, to increase their capital reserves, because that's a really key competitive issue for them.
And if they give them too long of a time, this begins to look like a way of getting around Congress, which would have been the other way to do this, basically to extend the regulatory regime to non-bank holding companies. But instead, the Treasury chose to do this because it was a way to do it much, much more quickly.
Sure. And I mean, I think the amount of time, really, you know, the key consideration is the competitive issue. I don't think there is a lot of criticism of the speed with which this bank holding company aspect of, you know, the various financial measures we're seeing has happened because, you know, it's relatively unintrusive. It's making a lending facility that's available to a lot of other competitors available to these other companies. And speed is really important right now. I mean, the other thing that I think is interesting about the bank holding company issue is something that people on Wall Street are calling the water mattress effect, which is when the government, either the Treasury or the Federal Reserve, has moved in to rescue one troubled part of the financial sector, it has often found it has to extend those same measures to everybody else. Otherwise, unintentionally, it changes the competitive landscape, and the previously relatively healthy parts of the financial sector find suddenly all the money is fleeing from them to the rescued area. So that's why I think some of these measures are turning out to be much more complicated than maybe was initially envisaged.
And listen to those bankers from the 70s getting seasick on their waterbeds with their metaphors about, you push down one side and it pops up the other side. Adora?
Quick question for you, Christia, just to expand on that last thought. If speed is important, what are the foreseen unintended consequences of changing this financial landscape so quickly?
Well, I don't think we know, and I think that's something that is, you know, probably one of the biggest issues that President-elect Obama and his new Secretary of the Treasury will face. You know, we really are in uncharted waters right now.
Uncharted waterbeds, actually.
Uncharted waterbeds.
Yes,
there you go.
There you
a
go.
Lot of water metaphors this morning.
Right.
But, you know, we are in this situation where the U.S. government has taken equity stakes in 9 of the biggest banks already, where we have unprecedented lending from the Federal Reserve, where we have this plan to buy up toxic assets. It's not really entirely clear how that's going to work. And what I think is really important also is this is happening internationally as well.
And much,
all of these banks are international players.
Much, much more to come. And we had a story yesterday that the Fed has already been lending to banks overseas, and we don't even know where that money is. Chrystia Freeland, thanks so much for joining us right at the top of the show, U.S. Managing Editor for the Financial Times. Thanks so much.
Great pleasure.
And now another economic indicator.
Yeah, a slice of the economy, really. We're talking lobster. The prices hit a 25-year low. It's so bad, some lobstermen are docking their boats at a time when lobster catches are actually better than ever. Tough times, you can hear in Jay Gustafaro's, in his voice, a lobsterman in Massachusetts.
The threshold is probably around the $3 range, really. If you catch 100 pounds of lobsters at $3 a pound, that's expenses.
So he's cutting even. Trevor Corson is the author of The Secret Lives of Lobsters and The Story of Sushi. He joins us here in the studio, and you are actually also a lobsterman for 2 years.
That's right.
So what are the main obstacles here?
It's kind of funny. When you're talking about this as an economic indicator, in a way the lobster fishery is, you know, when you have all these banks and mortgage lenders and everything undercapitalized, the lobster fishery is overcapitalized right now. They're actually a victim of their success right now because they have done such a good job conserving the lobster resource and fishing sustainably and taking care of the basis, the foundation of their business for the past 15, 20 years that they've seen the catches going up and up and up. And now there's so much supply that, you know, a slight dip in demand like we're seeing now with this recession kicking in. Suddenly, they've got so much lobster, they don't know what to do with it.
And it's still a luxury. I mean, people think of it as a luxury, so they feel like they're splurging, even if lobster doesn't cost that much.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because lobster 100 years ago was junk food. You know, like no one would eat it because they were these underwater bugs, right? And its status, you know, has just skyrocketed over the past century into this luxury item. And, you know, the lobstermen, when I was working on fishing boats in the mid-90s in Maine, you know, the catches were extraordinarily high. They'd never been like that before. And a part of it was that, like I said, they had a very healthy resource. And so they could afford to be catching all those lobsters. The thing was that they were really, even in those days, they were catching more lobsters than there was really demand for, even in the 90s, you know, even when we were all feeling a lot flusher.
Well, then how did the fishermen continue to make money then?
Exactly. So that's where this financial crisis has given the lobstermen a little extra, you know, knife in the back right now, because what they were doing was the excess lobster, they were shipping up to Canada to these processing plants that used to process codfish and other stuff. And with those species, you know, decimated from overfishing, they had all this extra processing capacity, and the lobsters were going there, and that's, you know, where you were getting all this frozen lobster tail meat and stuff that was processed and then sent out to chains like Red Lobster. And, you know, when you see a lobster linguine special at a mid-level restaurant,
right,
that's where it's coming from. And the thing that happened in the past month was that those Canadian processors had their finances, their short-term loan stuff tied up with all these Icelandic banks that have had all this trouble. So they've just been wiped off the map all of a sudden. So
they can't get loans.
Right. Yeah. And so the lobsters are coming home to roost, so to speak. Suddenly, the fishermen in Maine and in New England are faced with the fact that actually they've been getting a free ride on all this extra supply for the past 10, 15 years. And now they're going to have to realize maybe the market can't support all that. And they need to think about maybe fishing less, continuing to have a higher quality product, but, you know, not so much of it.
Well, it's interesting just to see how it ripples through the economy, and that, you know, something that happens in Iceland financially is going to end up on your plate at Olive Garden.
Absolutely. I mean, when I was a crewman on a lobster boat, you know, the father of the guy that I fished with was, you know, this old timer who didn't catch very much, and he piddled along and did very well for himself. And now, you know, they've got huge boats and speedy everything.
Trevor Corson, we're going to ask you to stick around for a minute. Trevor Corson is the author of The Secret Lives of Lobsters.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. We like to shake things up here at The Takeaway. We're talking about the lobster industry that's taking a big hit in this financial meltdown, as John likes to describe it. And with us is Trevor Corson, who is the author of The Secret Life of Lobsters and also the author of The Story of Sushi. And we're going to be talking about food in this segment, not just the lobster industry. Upcoming holidays. Are lobstermen, are they expecting to take an even greater hit?
Well, it's funny because their big Christmas boom every year is shipping plane loads of lobsters to Europe, especially to France, where there's this tradition of Christmas Eve lobster dinner. And I suspect they will be taking a big hit because, of course, the Europeans are not doing very well either right now with that. But what's a little bit sad about this situation is that the lobstermen have been plowing a lot of all this money they've been making over the past decade, catching all these extra lobsters into bigger, faster boats, fancier equipment. You know, before the break, I was talking about the old guys who had very simple setup. So, of course, now their fuel costs are higher and everything. And the ones who've foregone some of that and saved up for a rainy day, so to speak, now they're going to do all right. They've been doing very well for the past decade, and the lobster fishery is a real success story. So to the extent that they're going to be hurting, you know, this year and maybe for the next year or two, it's because they're a victim of their own success.
Do they play B-52s on their boats? Do you hear that
you know,
song
every morning, 4 a.m., I get on a boat. Not that
here
song
we go.
Again.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Trevor, thank you. So, you know, you talk about the holiday meal. There's no more cost-effective meal than Thanksgiving, all right? I mean, it's a gigantic meal that you have to make every year, but actually pound for pound, it's a reasonable alternative to some of the expensive meals that you could make in holidays or otherwise.
Melissa this Clark might be the year to think about lobster for Thanksgiving.
It might be, yeah. Right. Lobster rolls. Stuff your turkey with lobster at Thanksgiving. Joining us now is Melissa Clark, who's a New York Times food writer, who's brought biscuits into the studio, who is a new mom, has been to the show before, and since we saw you last, you're now a new mom with a set of challenges for Thanksgiving. And from my perspective, Thanksgiving is tough not so much because of the scale of the meal, but the timing of the meal. To make it all work out and servable at the same time, I never get that right. You have some special problems. What are you thinking about this year?
Well, actually, that's such a good point about serving everything at the same time. I think that is the biggest challenge of Thanksgiving because you're so focused on the turkey. I mean, at least we are in our house. It's all about, you know, getting this turkey perfect, and we all kind of spend the whole day around the oven. And then the side dishes and the desserts and the salads, they kind of fall to the side. And if we hadn't thought about them ahead, we would never get them done. And that is my big trick this year. And actually, every year, to be honest, I mean, I'm a new mom. I've got a gorgeous 5-week-old baby.
Of course you do.
Of course I do. But I'm not changing the way I do Thanksgiving. I'm scaling it down. I'll do a little less. But my big trick every year is I make things ahead.
How far ahead? And what can you do ahead?
I'm starting now.
You can't take a turkey out now.
And you can't do the only thing you can't do ahead is the turkey and the gravy because you need the pan drippings from the turkey to make
right.
the gravy. Everything else you can do ahead. And I'm serious. I'm starting now. Those biscuits,
right.
I could freeze them and I could serve them for Thanksgiving, except that you guys should eat them because they're really good and they're warm.
You can't take them back,
no,
Melissa.
That's a takeaway. No. No, you have to eat them because they're warm. But I think that you're big. Are they good?
Very good.
A little salami.
But you can bake bread and freeze it?
You can bake bread and freeze it, and that's what I've done every year up until now, but I have a new trick this year that I really want to share with you guys. I'm going to bake the dough. I mean, I'm going to make the dough ahead, and I'm going to freeze the dough, and I'm going to bake it that day. So we're going to have fresh baked bread on Thanksgiving instead of frozen bread that's been reheated, which is perfectly delicious and fine, but we're going to have it fresh.
Can't do potatoes ahead.
Potatoes, you can't do mashed potatoes ahead because they get kind of gluey, but have you ever had a mashed potato casserole?
No.
No.
Okay, this is such a good trick. You can make mashed potatoes the day before.
Right.
You can layer them in a casserole dish with cheese. Melted cheese, by the way, will save anything. If you put melted cheese on something and then you reheat it the next day, no one will know the difference.
It doesn't work on ice cream.
You're right. Yeah. But aside from that, it'll even work on the turkey, though. But if you do, if you can do a mashed potato, make your mashed potatoes ahead, layer them in a casserole with something really moist to keep them juicy when you bake them the next day. I like to use caramelized onions and some grated cheese on top. You assemble that, and you can pretty much assemble anything with, if you use a little cheese and a little bit of caramelized onion for any vegetable and you put it in a casserole dish, you can do it the day before and then just bake it while your turkey's in the oven. Or you know how you have that half an hour where you take your turkey out of the oven and your oven is free while you're letting the turkey kind of rest before you carve it? Put it in the oven then.
Oh, that's for warming stuff.
Right. You can warm it up.
If you're organized, though.
You have to be organized.
Generally, it's like we have the turkey and everything else is jammed in there because we're trying to cook it all at the same time.
Well, that's the thing. If you have it all, you can either I mean, it's tough because if you have a small oven. If you have a microwave, you can do a lot of the last-minute reheating in the microwave instead of the oven, which I think a lot of people are reluctant to do because, you know, you think, well...
Well, because the Pilgrims did.
I mean, that's why. How do you know?
The Pilgrims did not have a microwave.
They didn't, but I know that the Native Americans did. So
there we go. So, Trevor, we've got a bunch of lobsters, right?
I'm thinking now maybe planning ahead for Thanksgiving. I'll make my sushi 2 weeks in advance and then put some melted cheese on it.
Okay, yeah, sushi and lobster really don't work with the melted cheese. It's really more of a vegetable thing.
I'm going to try it.
So what is on your menu? Can you give us your menu, Melissa?
Our menu this year is going to be, like I said, we're scaling down.
Right.
But can I just tell you about the breads I'm going to make?
Yes.
I'm very excited about the breads. I feel like it's another thing about timing. You can bake the breads, and even if you bake them early in the morning, you still bake them that day, and they're going to be good all day long and something really fresh. So if you put them on the table, they will disappear. And I'm doing an Anadama bread. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
Trevor, have you heard of that? Because it's a New England thing, and I think the lobster man might know something about Anadama, it's called.
Anadama? I've heard the last part of that word on lobster
Exactly. Apparently, it's about a fisherman. The story goes that a fisherman cursed his wife because she was a bad baker.
There you go.
But this bread is fabulous.
Name.
I know.
And so is it a wheat bread?
It's a wheat yeasted bread with cornmeal and a little bit of molasses, which gives it this rich color and sweet taste.
Sure.
And it is such a good bread to serve fresh out of the oven, slathered with butter. And I guarantee that this is a perfect Thanksgiving thing. It's a New England bread, so it's American.
Okay.
It goes with the season.
That's one. Less than a minute to go. What are the rest of the breads?
The biscuits you're eating, salami with scallions.
These are fabulous.
Corn crackers, cornmeal crackers with lots of black pepper gives it a kick. They are delicious. And then my favorite, Parker House rolls, everybody loves them, with cranberry butter put inside, layered inside.
Cranberry butter, that's
so good,
that
and they're beautiful
yummy.
Because they're red.
All stuff you can make ahead.
You freeze the dough, you bake them that day, and people will love you.
Oh, I love you. Melissa Clark, New York Times food writer, and Trevor Corson, I don't love you, the author of The Secret Lives of Lobsters. Thanks so much to both of you.
Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. We have the latest headlines for you from Femi Okay. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Dora. The time is 28 minutes to the top of the hour. Congressional Democrats want another bailout, this time for the automakers. They need to get President Bush on their side if they hope to get it signed into law. The Treasury Department turned down General Motors' request for help late last month. A new bailout plan to help homeowners is coming under fire. FDIC Chief Sheila Bair says that the plan falls short. It allows certain troubled borrowers to get mortgage adjustments, but it only applies to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac loans. Premature birth rates vary widely from state to state, according to a new report from the March of Dimes. They say it's as low as 9% in Vermont and as high as nearly 19% in Mississippi, generally rising as you move south. Dr. Alan Fleischman is the medical director for the March of Dimes. He says there's a lot that mums-to-be can do to avoid having premature babies.
They can start their pregnancies healthy. They can be sure to deal with problems like smoking and alcohol and drugs and nutrition.
And the federal government wants to reduce premature births to 7.6% by 2010. Bad weather could delay Friday's launch of the space shuttle Endeavour. A cold front is moving across the country and may bring rain to the launch site. But the astronauts are ready for the liftoff if the mission goes through, when they will install several new rooms in the International Space Station. And that's a look at your news for now.
Thanks very much, Femi. Now we're going to take another look at a slice of the economy, and we're going to Wilmington, Ohio.
They're taking away everything from me, my family, my friends, this whole town.
That's a devastated woman on CNN expressing her feelings after DHL, the German shipping company, announced it would cut almost 10,000 jobs in the United States. Wilmington, just outside Cincinnati, could lose nearly 7,000 of those jobs, more than half of the small town's population. Joining us for more is Joe Ingles, who has been covering the story for months for Ohio Public Radio. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning.
Now, DHL, the folks there were certainly expecting some cuts, but not an ultimate shutdown.
Yes, they were expecting some cuts, but they thought they were at least going to have the sorting facility or some skeleton of it so that some folks would still be there in a, you know, in a very light crew to kind of process things as they came through. They never expected DHL to shut down its entire operation.
And explain how that works, because it's not just DHL employees themselves, but they are also related companies where many jobs will be lost.
Yes, DHL is part of a large air park that was built basically for DHL years ago, and there's also A-Star, and there's also ABX. These companies provide the support services for DHL. They provide the people to work on the planes. They provide pilots for planes, those sorts of things. So if there aren't planes going in and out of there, then they're not going to need the pilots, and they're not going to need the mechanics, and so it's a cyclical thing.
And it's like a virus. It very quickly spreads to everything, from movie theaters to grocery stores, right?
You know, that's the real problem here. One out of every three adults in Clinton County depends on DHL for employment. And when you don't have people working, then you don't have people spending. And I'll tell you how bad this is. Just yesterday, Whirlpool in another part of the state cut 945 workers. Now, that's on top of the 5,000 that they've already cut earlier this year. And the reason they're cutting workers is they're not selling their appliances. The reason they can't sell their appliances is people are worried about their jobs. We see the same thing in the auto industry here in Ohio. 19,000 jobs have been lost this year, and a lot of those have been in the auto industry as they've shut down plants, they've laid off people. And the auto industry is not recovering here in Ohio. People are not buying cars. We're seeing dealerships that have been around forever. They're going under because people just don't have the money to buy the cars. So, and another indication of a problem is we have an unemployment compensation trust fund. It's set to run out of money next month because so many people here are unemployed. Our governor, Governor Strickland, has been lobbying Congress to get more money for the fund, and he wants to extend the existing benefits. But right now, that fund is going to be completely dry next month.
So the Wilmington mayor, who called the DHL closing a catastrophe for the entire region, I am certain that that could easily have been the governor who said that. What's the plan? What are they talking about to help these people, particularly in Wilmington?
Well, they have a few things. Because they had been expecting some layoffs, they had already had a group of people together, state, local people together, to try to facilitate, you know, additional job training, some sort of, you know, make sure that if there are other jobs out there that people know about them and are able to connect to them. They've got, you know, additional opportunities for people to be able to retrain in areas where they may be weak, say they need computer skills or something like that.
But where would they get jobs, Joe?
That's the problem. That is the problem right there, because there are so many people in Ohio who are without work, and it just, the number just keeps climbing and climbing. There really aren't places to send them.
What are the obstacles, Joe, to people becoming commuters into the Cincinnati area? What are the distances and what are the sort of costs associated with commuting from Clinton County?
Well, now, I grew up around Clinton County, so I'm very familiar with that area, and it's still an hour's drive to from Wilmington to Cincinnati, especially when you have traffic. It's an hour's drive to get down there, and it's not an easy drive because, gas is expensive, even though the price has come down. When you're talking about commuting, it is expensive, and you got to remember, Cincinnati is not flush with jobs either.
And in talking to people, how are they planning on coping, or do they even know, given that so many didn't expect this to happen?
I was talking to my family, and they happened to be out and about on the day that DHL, yesterday when it was announced, and they said that they went into one of the businesses and in a county that's contiguous to Clinton County. This isn't even Clinton County. You got to remember that all the counties around there also have people employed at DHL. And, some of the employees were just crying because they have spouses, they have children, they have people, you know, mm-hmm. that are affecting their family, you know, who are being affected by DHL's loss. So people just don't know what they're going to do.
Tough, tough times. Joe Ingles, thank you so much for being with us this morning. Joe is a reporter for Ohio Public Radio.
And we're talking about whether the auto industry should be bailed out. What do you think? You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or do what Rose did. Frankly, the U.S. auto industry has refused to see the future, and more money handed to them without very tight conditions will simply be lost. Why should we bail out companies who have refused to invest in research? What we must do is look to the people who have worked and do work in the industry and pay them out and retrain current workers in green industries. What's your take on the auto industry bailout? Washington's talking about it. You can too. 877-8-MY-TAKE or myticketthetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckabee. Joining us now is Sadia Zahidi, who's Associate Director of the World Economic Forum. She joins us from London. Sadia, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Now, the reason we asked you on the program is to talk about this interesting report that suggests that women not being in the financial industry is possibly one reason why this meltdown has happened so precipitously across the globe, and that one key to restoring economic health to the financial sector is getting more women at the top of financial institutions. First of all, the cause for the problems that we're exhibiting now, where have you seen this in management in financial institutions around the world, and how do you rate the companies?
Well, we're actually looking at countries. So we're looking at country rankings. We're looking at the gender gap in the most comprehensive way possible, gaps on health, education, economic participation, and political empowerment. And what we then do is do a simple correlation with country competitiveness. And what that's telling us is basically if countries have big gender gaps, they also tend to be performing poorly on competitiveness. And there's a lot of reasons that go behind that, but one of it is just very, very simple. Women make up one half of the human resources of any country. If that one half is not as healthy, not as educated as men, not being channeled into the economy, and not being made part of political decision-making structures, that country's competitive potential will suffer. Now, if we link it up to what's happening currently, you know, it's a question that we have to pose ourselves. If women were more part of some of the decision-making structures, whether it's in governance or in financial institutions, that would be reflective of a more diverse environment that allows the best ideas to flourish rather than letting one half of the population not be represented.
Well, you've talked statistically about the fact that if women aren't represented in countries and major companies inside of countries that you've ranked, mm-hmm. it's an indication that they aren't thinking strategically and competitively about their businesses. But beyond that, what do you think women bring to the table in these management jobs that would, you know, bring something fundamentally different than what men already bring?
You know, I think there's two ways to think of it. One is, of course, there's a lot of studies out there that show that women have a different style of risk aversion, are perhaps more risk averse than men. Women have a different style, potentially, of decision making, are more inclusive in their decision making, and tend to look at the best ideas out there before taking some of those decisions. So there is one set of research that says that, and that's an efficiency argument. But if we look at it just in terms of representation, if women make up one half of the talent pool, they should really be making it to the very top levels of decision-making, too,
and that's an equity argument.
The
equity argument is certainly very, very strong. Quickly before we go, what are the rankings? Who's top and who's bottom?
The Nordic countries are once again at the very top of the rankings. Countries such as Chad and Yemen and Pakistan are at the very bottom. The United States is at number 27 this year.
And, you know, what countries are near it? And is that an indication that we're declining in our diversity or increasing in our diversity?
The United States is actually, we have 3 years' worth of data now, has actually been going up in the rankings. So that's certainly a very positive trend. And much of that has been driven actually by increases in political empowerment, which is one factor where the United States was ranking quite low before.
And more of that to come with this election. Saadia Zahidi, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Saadia Zahidi is Associate Director of the World Economic Forum. She spoke with us from London about gender inequality and more gender equality as a competitive driver in the world economy.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, November 12th, and we have the latest headlines for you from Femi Oke.
Hello there, Adora. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Wall Street opens next hour. Futures traders are betting on a flat opening. Not too volatile in world markets so far. European markets have been mixed. Asian markets closed down just a bit. Treasury Chief Hank Paulson will have an update on the $700 billion bailout plan later this morning. It's been a busy week for Paulson, with pressure to give money to carmakers and criticism of how funds are being doled out to banks. President-elect Barack Obama is adding two big names to his transition team. Former Secretary of State Warren Christopher will advise on State Department issues, and former Georgia Senator Sam Nunn will do the same for the Pentagon. A nasty weather system could foil the Friday launch of NASA's Space Shuttle Endeavour. Astronauts are still ready for the mission, which would bring new gear to improve the International Space Station so it can take a larger crew. And finally, Sasha Obama has started a little fashion flurry. The black dress she wore to her father's acceptance speech last week has been renamed the Sasha. The dress is made by the company Gerson & Gerson, and the company president Barbara Zines got quite emotional when she found out that 7-year-old Sasha had worn one of their dresses.
I shed a few tears over this. I think we all did. We come to work every day and, you know, we're just sort of your average schmoes making dresses here in the back room.
And the Sasha can now be found in an assortment of colors, including ivory, pink, and gray. But I don't think they make them in our sizes, Adora.
Are you saying we're out of luck?
I think we're a little big for the flouncy party dress for a 7-year-old. We could try.
Fashion leaders, Femi Oke and Adora Udoji, thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
This morning, Indian defense sources say the nation test-fired a medium-range supersonic nuclear-capable missile from a land-based launcher. The K-15 has an undersea capability. It has a range of up to 435 miles, and it is yet another reminder that South Asia is going to be a big priority for the new President Barack Obama. As part of our ongoing series, America's Briefing Book, we're going to take a look at South Asia now with a particular emphasis on Pakistan. Joining us is MJ Gohel, director of the Asia-Pacific Foundation, a London-based international affairs think tank. MJ Gohel is in London. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, John.
Let's begin with some of the rhetoric that was traded in the campaign about Pakistan vis-a-vis, you know, Barack Obama and al-Qaeda and some of the traditional issues that we've been dealing with for quite a while. First, here is Barack Obama.
If Pakistan is unable or unwilling to hunt down bin Laden and take him out, then we should. Now, that, I think, has to be our policy because they are threatening to kill more Americans.
And here's Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari.
Let's see how far we can be the part of the solution, and we can assist Obama to come up, President Obama elect to come up with a world solution to a lot of problems.
MJ Gohel, between now and inauguration, what are the dividing lines and the tension points between the United States and Pakistan? And we shouldn't forget that often Pakistan is viewed through the war on terror lens, but there's a whole range of issues that relate to Pakistan's relationship with India.
Well, yes, indeed. I think during the next U.S. presidency, Pakistan will prove to be one of the greatest challenges for the new administration, because Pakistan is home to al-Qaeda and the Taliban. The trail from a number of terrorist attacks keeps leading back to Pakistan. A global jihad, the infrastructure exists there. And this is a country which has proliferated nuclear technology to countries like North Korea, Iran, and Libya. And this is a country which is teetering on the verge of bankruptcy. So Pakistan is a very, very dangerous country and will prove to be an enormous challenge for President-elect Barack Obama.
And, of course, now there's a new civilian leadership in Pakistan. How different is it going to be, and how much more challenging is it going to be for the U.S. government to deal with a civilian leadership than the more relatively simple Musharraf regime that President Bush had to deal with?
Well, there is a civilian leadership at the moment, but unfortunately, that country's history is such that the army and its notorious intelligence agency, the ISI, are always there in the shadows. For half of this country's life, the military has intervened and usurped democracy there. Now, in fact, Barack Obama has said that he's willing to give more assistance, more U.S. financial aid, if Pakistan maintains a democratic infrastructure. The thing is this, that the military really controls Pakistan, and President Bush put a lot of faith in Pervez Musharraf and his military. Bush gave over $10 billion in aid over the last 7 years, plus debt write-offs, plus military supplies and other covert payments. In return, the Pakistani military did not deliver at any level. Osama bin Laden is still out there. Mullah Omar of the Taliban is there. There's something like 20,000 Taliban fighters milling around in safe havens within Pakistan. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, the policy towards Pakistan has failed. Pakistan has not delivered. And the question is that, can a civilian government now deliver? It's very unlikely, unless the military, which actually sponsored and nurtured the Taliban, is willing to come on board in this war on terror.
And MJ, there's some real questions about where all those billions of dollars actually went. But in terms of dealing with the army and the civilian government, what do you believe the U.S. needs to do in order for this relationship to work better towards the goal, the U.S.'s goal of getting to al-Qaeda?
Well, Adora, you raise a very important point here. This summer, a U.S. House subcommittee uncovered evidence of graft and corruption in the more than $6 billion worth of U.S. military aid that was given to the Musharraf government. A lot of that money has just gone missing. Nobody knows where it is. And now Pakistan's asking for another $10 billion in aid. The key question here is that there has to be accountability. Money can no longer be just handed over to Pakistan. Pakistan. I think it's going to be very important for Barack Obama and the new administration in the U.S. to demand results for the money that is being given, to demand evidence of where that money is going. Is it being used to reform the country? Is the aid percolating downwards towards the poor sections of the community there? Are the madrasas going to be reformed so that they no longer act as incubation centers for new generations of suicide bombers? And will the money be used to eradicate the global jihadi infrastructure that exists in that country?
But let's be real, though. I mean, people in Pakistan don't necessarily view the payments from the United States as specific, strategically targeted monies to change things inside Pakistan. They view it as a payoff. The U.S. is paying off Pakistan to keep the screws on. And so how the money is used, the Congress can yell and scream about it, but the international community views this as basically a payoff.
Well, I think you're right, John, about that, that it really is basically a payoff. But on the other hand, it's important to win hearts and minds at the grassroots level in Pakistan. The fact is...
Does that argue for a dialogue with the Taliban, as the Bush administration has floated and even the Barack Obama administration has suggested might be possible?
No, I would suggest that that cannot be done. There is no such thing as a moderate Taliban, and that's a non-starter. What I'm saying is that there are a lot of people in Pakistan who don't actually understand fully how generous the U.S. is, and it's important for them to know that. I mean, for instance, when the Pakistani earthquake took place in 2005,
right,
the U.S. and a number of Western countries supplied a massive amount of financial and other aid. Now, all of that aid somehow ended up in the hands of Islamic terrorist groups. Now, these terrorist groups were actually handing out that aid to the earthquake victims right under the noses of the Pakistani military, and in fact, right under the noses of Western media. And as a result of that, those Islamic terrorist groups were establishing more support at the grassroots level, whereas it should be the U.S. that should have got that support.
So better grassroots support and a better sort of U.S. brand on the ground to win those hearts and minds. MJ Gohil, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
MJ Gohil is director of the Asia-Pacific Foundation, London-based international affairs think tank, and that's another page for Barack Obama's briefing book from America's briefing book right here at The Takeaway.
Or two pages, or three, and we can add some today from our website, in that folks are talking about the auto industry and whether or not congressional leaders should bail it out. There's a lively discussion. Elizabeth Knoll writes, instead of bailing them out, spend money on a countrywide rail system, model it on the Eurorail. What do you think should be done about the auto industry? Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And here's your takeaway.
There aren't really that many financial institutions left which haven't essentially surrendered and said, you know what, we're going to have to be boring bank holding companies.
That's the Financial Times' Christia Freeland talking about American Express becoming one of those boring banking companies.
We're always on at The Takeaway. Our podcast is on iTunes with everything you missed today. You can subscribe at our website, thetakeaway.org, and even though the election is over, Thanksgiving's coming up. You're going to want that Thanksgiving advice from Melissa Clark earlier today. I'm John Hockenberry.
Biscuits are good. I'm Adore Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Will healthcare do-nothings finally do something?
One of the things that I have said from the start of this campaign is that we have a moral commitment as well as an economic imperative to do something about the healthcare crisis that so many families are facing.
A briefing on healthcare for America, for the new president, for an industry wondering if there will be any money left over after the financial rescue. Healthcare stands in line with the rest of us on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, November 12th. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Adora.
Coming up this hour, lobbyists in D.C. have their hands out for a piece of the $700 billion bailout package. Plus, moderate Republicans, are they an endangered species? And we take a look at health care. Those stories are coming up, but first, headlines.
President Bush is on the way out, but he may have one more fight with Democrats before he goes. Democratic leaders in Congress want American automakers to get a share of the billion-dollar bailout fund. The White House says that money is reserved for financial institutions. It's a New York Times front page story today, and we'll talk to the reporter in just a moment. Speaking of that bailout, Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson will tell us how it's all going at a news conference later this morning.
Also on Capitol Hill, a proposal, a new government plan, is promising to help struggling homeowners with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac mortgages.
This streamlined program is meant to reach as many of these borrowers as possible to give them a chance to save their homes and begin restoring their credit.
That's federal housing official James Lockhart. But critics, including the FDIC chief, says it doesn't reach nearly enough. President-elect Barack Obama is adding two big names to his transition team. Former Georgia Senator Sam Nunn will advise him on Pentagon issues. Former Secretary of State Warren Christopher will do the same for the State Department. Nunn often comes up as a possible Secretary of Defense and was even mentioned as a potential Obama running mate.
Hey, folks, if the coverage of the transition is putting you to sleep, there are still three undecided Senate race cliffhangers that are keeping things interesting and giving you a political fix. Republicans currently hold the Alaska, Minnesota, and Georgia seats, so Democrats are hoping for pickups. In Minnesota, just over 200 votes make up Republican Senator Norm Coleman's lead over Democratic challenger Al Franken. That's out of nearly 3 million votes cast. Now comes the legally mandated recount. There has already been legal wrangling and accusations of irregularities. We may not know the winner for a while. Sound familiar?
Wall Street opens up in less than an hour. Future traders are betting on an essentially flat opening. European markets have been mixed. Asian markets closed lower, though not too far down.
Although Wall Street seems to be bumping maybe a little bit lower. I don't know what has happened. Something sort of transpired in the last hour. But we are talking about the auto industry bailout. It could be depression about the auto industry is weighing down stocks this morning. But what do you think? Should there be a bailout for the auto industry? Or has the auto industry made its own bed and now has to sleep in it? You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Get in on the debate. Washington's going to.
Yeah, are you planning on calling one of your congressional leaders who are currently debating this issue? Should they give the money? Should they put the money someplace else? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Today, our partners at The New York Times are reporting that nearly all of the $350 billion of the first installment of the bailout package has been set aside, spoken for, and the shrinking pie, as well as ambiguity over which companies are eligible, has set off a lobbyist feeding frenzy. Mark Landler, who's covering the story for The New York Times, he joins us. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
So what's going on here?
Well, it's a lobbying free-for-all, the likes of which Washington hasn't seen for a long time, which is prompted by a couple of things. One, the pot of money was enormous when it was first announced, which was enough to spark a lot of interest initially. But beyond that, there's increasing concern on the part of people who might be eligible or think they're eligible for the money that there actually is less of it than maybe they expected, insofar as a lot of it is already being committed. And they're down to the last $60 billion of the first installment of money they got.
And who is thinking that perhaps they may qualify when much of the discussion has been about bailing out the financial institutions that keep the economy moving?
Well, the twist is whether you consider yourself to be a financial institution. And it turns out that that definition is more elastic than many people may have expected at first. Initially, it applied to banks, savings and loans, and even insurance companies that either own banks or savings and loans, a category that probably numbered something like 8,000 institutions. But as the program got rolling, companies that had a more tenuous connection to banking but a real connection to the financial world began to think, you know, gee, maybe we qualify. In that category, you would put industrial lenders like GE Capital or GMAC, which is the financing arm of General Motors.
Mark, I've lent a lot of money to my brother. Do I qualify?
You'd have to reclassify yourself as a bank holding company, John. But, you know, that's, I mean, someone said to me the other day, why doesn't Circuit City reclassify itself as a bank? And then maybe they can get bailed out, which sounds like a joke. But when you consider that General Motors and the other automakers would like to be included in the bailout package, it doesn't actually sound that far-fetched anymore.
It all sounds so simple, and I guess what I'm wondering is, given the discussion at the time of the bailout package, there was much said about oversight and transparency, and you're also injecting lobbyists now into this. Who is keeping track of what's happening, how the Treasury is making these decisions, and who's getting all the money?
Well, here's the other problem, which our story doesn't address specifically, but we probably will be thinking about in coming weeks, which is that the oversight for the program is not even fully installed yet. There's a special inspector general who's supposed to oversee the program. That person hasn't been named yet. There's a congressional oversight committee, not up and running fully. There's an internal oversight committee, which is working and meeting, but that consists of people like Treasury Secretary Paulson and the Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke, who were the people involved in setting up the program. So the oversight, which under the congressional law is supposed to be quite elaborate, hasn't really taken effect. And as we, as you said at the beginning, a lot of the money has already been committed.
So the cart is moving before the horses.
Absolutely.
And do you anticipate that to change at all, given some of the reporting that the New York Times and other outlets have been doing to highlight some of these systematic problems that seem to be emerging?
Well, yes, I do. Senator Christopher Dodd said yesterday that he wants to hold hearings of the Senate Banking Committee to discuss how this money is being dispersed. Congressman Barney Frank, the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, also wants to hold oversight hearings later this month. So the key lawmakers that were involved in the creation of this are really sitting up and taking notice. Also, you'll have the new administration and the President-elect Barack Obama taking a very close look at the program and presumably making some decisions about things they'd like to tweak or change even more radically.
Mark Landler, as always, many thanks to you.
Thanks very much.
Mark Landler is a reporter for the New York Times, bringing us up to date on the bailout.
Well, as Mark has suggested, almost anything can happen when you have that much money at stake in Washington. But at this point, any sort of bailout of the auto industry does appear to be separate from the financial bailout, and it's something that will be discussed in the congressional session that gets going next week. David Herzenhorn of the New York Times is covering that story. And the congressional leaders want a bailout fast-tracked, David. And first of all, what are the numbers that they're talking about? And given that there's already ostensibly been a disagreement between President Bush and President-elect Obama about this, can this lame duck Congress actually preempt President Bush before Barack Obama takes office?
No. Good morning, John. The answer is that, whatever the Congress passes in the upcoming lame duck session, President Bush would still have to sign. So there, you know, this has been a little bit of a waiting game as congressional leaders look for a signal from the White House about what were they willing to do, not just on the auto industry, but first on sort of a broader economic stimulus package that would include unemployment, extension of unemployment benefits, food stamp increase, infrastructure spending, you know, public works projects to get more jobs going. So, you know, President Bush still has, you know, the final authority here to sign or veto a bill. The numbers that they're talking about are at least $25 billion. There were $25 billion in loans that Congress approved before it left for the campaign this fall that the White House is saying, you know, why don't you focus there? You know, that money has some strings attached to it that basically from last year's energy bill say they have to use that money for increasing energy efficiency on cars. You know, the White House is saying, couldn't you know, speed up that money and loosen the strings there before you start monkeying around with the $700 billion bailout? But we still don't know how this is going to play out. You know,
well, let's talk about that for a moment. I mean, when the rescue plan was being debated, it was suddenly discovered that House Republicans were an unexpected obstructionist group here. Is there any likelihood that the dynamics of this debate are going to present some difficulties for Nancy Pelosi and the Senate leadership?
Well, a lame duck congressional session is always a little unpredictable. I mean, consider that, you know, dozens of the lawmakers coming back to Washington are either retiring or they've been defeated. They were voted out of office. You know, some of them are not in the best of moods. They're not about to give in on something that for any reason they think is a bad idea. And, you know, so it does raise a whole series of questions about, you know, who would object under what, you know, grounds. I mean, is it that the $700 billion should have gone only for financial companies? I mean, in the end, the money is fungible, right? It's all coming from the taxpayers. It's all charged to the national credit card at the moment.
Right. And that's an Amex card, we understand, as of yesterday. Now, David, you know, the auto industry reported last week, Ford and General Motors reported last week that they were burning through cash at something on the order of $3 billion a month. That's collectively. It varies from company to company. Is Congress likely to do anything that's going to help them in time to even matter?
Well, you know, that's a big question. I mean, and that's the reason, obviously, that Speaker Pelosi is pushing this right now on the fear that when GM talks about, you know, well, we'll run out of money in mid, you know, 2009, that in fact could be, you know, 3 weeks away. Who knows? You know, we've seen some of these things, you know, snowball very quickly, certainly on the financial institution side. So they're going to try, but you were just talking to Mark Landler about, you know, how hard it is to get the oversight up and running. You know, Congress, a legislative body, is not built to, you know, turn on a dime and move real fast. So it may not happen, you know, quick enough.
And in fact, the quickest thing might be to make the auto industry bank holding companies and put them in touch with this sort of $60 billion worth of money from the federal treasury. David Hertzenhorn, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
David Hertzenhorn is a reporter for The New York Times talking about the bailout for the proposed bailout for the auto industry that the Democratic leadership wants to fast track in the lame duck session.
And we have a very lively discussion about this very issue happening on our website. Here's what one of you called in to say.
Hi, this is Bob from New Jersey. If you go and put all your money into bailing out one industry, like the car industry, you're being unfair to everybody else. So far better than to pick and choose industries to save would be to put a whole bunch of money into generally unemployment insurance, food stamps, and COBRA health insurance benefits.
Mary Madsen writes on our website, of course, the executives of the auto industry dug their own grave. The problem is that the workers who will be buried if they are not bailed out. The CEOs will live quite comfortably regardless of what happens, just as they will in the financial industry.
Joe writes, to me, this story strongly highlights how we must move to a new economy of green jobs, infrastructure replacement, scientific industry. In other words, we've got to get away from an economy centered on all of this buying stuff we don't need.
877-8-MY-TAKE. You need to call that now. MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Today, a new report will shed light on the experience of nearly three dozen Guantanamo Bay detainees. Written by researchers at the Human Rights Center at the University of California, Berkeley, It's an unprecedented study based on interviews of the men and following their lives the past year and a half.
Well, they were released, right?
They were released. These were some of those who were released. Remember, John, there were nearly 800 men who were incarcerated or detained at Guantanamo Bay, and over 500 of them have been released. And this report is based on the experiences of 62 of them. Eric Stover, the director of the UC Berkeley Human Rights Center, co-authored the report, and he joins us from Washington. Good morning.
Good morning.
So explain the narrative that you discovered in talking to these 62 men in these unparalleled series of interviews.
Well, what we tried to do was to we interviewed 62 former detainees in nine countries, and what we tried to do with what we call a semi-structured questionnaire, that is, every detainee was asked the same questions, and what we tried to construct is from the point of their detention, all of them were detained either in Afghanistan or Pakistan. What was it like when you were detained in Afghanistan, transferred to Guantanamo? How were you treated at Guantanamo? And most importantly, what was it like to return home? Now, it's important to remember that the average time that these former detainees spent was 3 years in detention in Guantanamo. And like the 520 that have been released, none of them were convicted of a crime and were returned home without any type of assistance. We found that many of these detainees, once they got back into their homes or to third countries, it's often difficult to find countries that will take some of these, that they suffered from what we found was a Guantanamo stigma, that their families and their communities felt that these were dangerous men simply because they'd been at Guantanamo. And what haunted these men was the sense that they wanted to clear their names in some way. We found that only six of the 62 had actually found any kind of employment. And probably the most distressing, and more research needs to be done on this, we're just looking at a small sample, but that two-thirds of these detainees spoke of psychological problems as a result of what had happened to them in Guantanamo.
So based on their detention, what you've essentially concluded is that they wear psychologically a bright orange jumpsuit for everyone to see in their communities and can't really take that off no matter what they do.
That's right. Well, what happens is Guantanamo is not a detention center, really. It is an interrogation center. It was a system that was designed to extract information from these detainees. But the troubling thing is, and this is on the record, mm-hmm. we know three government officials from different agencies have said, you know, probably half to a third, and maybe more, of these detainees should never have been taken there. They were not a security threat. So these were men who came through. Some of the interrogators, the detainees told us, their own interrogators said, you shouldn't be here. But what happened at Guantanamo is this process where guards were collaborating with interrogators. You had mental health professionals working with interrogators. And in fact, the American Medical Association, American Public Health Association, the American Psychiatric Association have all come out and prohibited their members from participating in interrogations. So what happened, they got solitary confinement, exposed to extreme cold, this cumulative effect over the years and not knowing what was going to happen to them took quite a toll.
And what did you learn about how they got there in the first place?
Well, what we know is just after the war began in early October in Afghanistan of 2001, there were bounties scattered throughout Afghanistan and the border in Pakistan. And these bounties were offering $5,000 for anyone who captured somebody who looked like a suspect. And what happened is hundreds and thousands of men were abducted, detained. And then they were turned over to U.S. forces and brought to two camps, Kandahar and Bagram. And what we know at these camps is that they were under immense pressure to screen through these detainees and then send them on to Guantanamo. It's interesting that the commander in Guantanamo in 2002 was Major General Michael Dunleavy, and he actually went over to Afghanistan and he told interrogators of these camps, quit sending me these Mickey Mouse prisoners. You know, these guys, we don't, wow. You know, we need the hardcore. And so early on, they knew they had a problem here. And what we wanted to see is, well, what did it mean to these detainees who probably should never have been sent there in the first place.
I mean, the assumption in your report is that they have done really poorly after having been returned home. I'm wondering if there's any way to separate out their circumstances post-release from Gitmo from any suspicion that maybe they wouldn't have done so well anyway. I mean, these weren't people who were taken from, you know, university, you know, classrooms necessarily. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with them, but it's hard to know if they would have done any better had they not been detained.
No, that's a good question. We can't, you know, out of our sample of 62, we can't say that. We do know that what they told us, for example, was that they came back, and because they were the breadwinners in the family, they were unable to, their children weren't able to go to school, some had lost their businesses. You know, we had one was a doctor, and he couldn't restart his profession. But what we're trying to do is we're saying, look, we've been looked at a sample here. What we're calling for is the formation of an independent, nonpartisan commission that should make a full investigation of what's taken place.
Eric Stover, I think it's just want to note one other thing. There are roughly 200 detainees still at Guantanamo Bay, and only 23 of them have been charged with the crime. Eric Stover, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Eric Stover is the director of the UC Berkeley Human Rights Center, and he is one of the co-authors of the report, which is full of interviews of 62 former Gitmo detainees.
What else are we talking about on The Takeaway? Bailing out the auto industry.
Larry Conroy in Manhattan. Yes, I do think we should do the bailout bit for the auto industry, but it must come with conditions that they start making the cars that will cure the problems that we have had for the many years that the car industry has been turning out gas guzzlers.
What do you think of the bailout bit for the auto industry? 877-8-MY-TAKE. And now Femi Oke has some quick headlines.
Thanks, John. The time is 29 minutes past the hour. Barack Obama is adding two Washington vets to his transition team. Sam Nunn will head the Pentagon team, and Warren Christopher will watch over the State Department. Premature birth rates vary widely from state to state, according to a new report from March of Dimes. They say it generally rises as you move south. More than 500,000 U.S. babies are born premature each year. An American aid worker and his driver have been killed in northwest Pakistan. Assaults on foreign workers are uncommon there. And the UN's head of peacekeeping says he needs more than 3,000 fresh troops in eastern Congo. He says there aren't enough peacekeepers to protect civilians. That's a quick look at stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. More volatility on Wall Street. The markets have opened on Wall Street. The S&P is down 2% in the early going. Back in 1980, Ronald Reagan, former actor and former governor of California, put together a national coalition of religious conservatives and traditional Republicans to take the White House from Jimmy Carter and to start a Republican dynasty that Reagan believed was as strong as America itself.
We will always remember. We will always be proud. We will always be prepared, so we may be always free.
Well, somebody forgot something last Tuesday in the election of Barack Obama. The GOP was clearly unprepared for the 08 election. What is the road back? Is it to find a centrist path away from the religious conservatism of the Reagan era? Former Rhode Island senator and famously moderate Republican Lincoln Chafee joins us now. He's currently in Providence at Brown University's Watson Institute. Senator Chafee, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
My first question to you is, who is going to lead the Republican Party back, and how do you form a coalition that even could begin to match what Ronald Reagan did in 1980 based on the numbers that came out of last week's election?
Well, that's a huge question that the party's going to have to confront, because so many of the kind of Republicans that you described, the Rockefeller Republicans, Chafee Republicans, are gone. They've left the party. And I found that out when I was running in 2006, that when I went to my donors that had been so generous to me in 2000 when I first ran, they had left. They weren't giving anymore, disillusioned with the Republican policies and the priorities. And the traditional conservatism that I call, where we care about revenues matching expenditures, we care about the environment, we care about personal liberties, the Bill of Rights, not getting into these foreign entanglements. These are that's my kind of Rockefeller Republican, and I call it conservative values.
So your sense is that the party left you to begin with, and I guess what I would love to know from you is what you think John McCain represented. I mean, some have criticized McCain for not being enough of one or the other Republican, but kind of a bad mixture of both, and that's one reason why the McCain candidacy didn't work. What's your view?
Yes, it was unfortunate to see him change so much as he campaigned for the 2008 Republican nomination. When I served with him, we were the only two Republicans to vote against the big Bush-Cheney tax cuts in the spring of 2001. It was just Chafee and McCain.
Wow.
None of the other moderates were voting against the big tax cuts. He was good on the environment, consistently against drilling up in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, a key vote, very important vote, because those votes were so close. And then, of course, he was helpful in forming the Gang of 14, which addressed the Supreme Court nominees,
mm-hmm.
and charting a moderate path. And then when he campaigned for the Republican nomination, it was a different John McCain. And when he finally picked Sarah Palin, Governor Palin, as his running mate, it was the final pander to that Republican base that I don't think represents, as we saw in the election, manifest itself at the true America.
Senator, moving forward, what are the obstacles, the main issues that are going to determine, you believe, which direction the Republican Party moves in as they think about the next elections, the next congressional elections coming up in 2 years?
Well, it's a very noisy group in the Republican Party, very vocal and angry or mean, if you will. And they like to primary us moderates. They insult us, call us rhinos, Republican in name only, and the type. And from what I saw in the paper yesterday, one of the articles, they're rejoicing in driving out what they called wobbly kneed Republicans. And that makes no sense to me. We lost Oregon. We lost New Hampshire in 2008. In 2006, of course, lost Rhode Island, lost Montana. Losing a number of states, it just makes no sense. If you want to be chairman of committees, how can you keep driving out members of the party?
Well, you suggest that the GOP, before it goes forward, needs to cleanse itself of this internal battle between the sort of Palin-style conservatives, the culture war conservatives, and your so-called moderate conservatives. How's that war going to take place, and is there enough time to finish that off and still have enough of a lead in the election to actually present a united front?
Well, that's the key question the party's going to have to confront. And if they want to be a party of a few states in the South and a few Rocky Mountain states, they'll continue along the same path and choosing priorities, gay marriage and abortion, instead of addressing the economy and the environment and our international relations, which I think are the priorities of the American people. I do think Governor Huckabee came to Brown curiously and gave a speech before a packed audience and got a standing ovation after he was done at Brown University, liberal Brown University. He was able to be his social conservative but still be open to different voices in the audience. And they gave him a standing ovation when he was done.
Senator,
that was interesting.
Senator, who do you think is the Republican base today?
Well, it's, as I said, very vocal. They've got a mean streak to them, and they're fueled by a lot of the talk show hosts, Rush Limbaugh, Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, and all those names. There's a whole industry out there. And I believe that if John McCain had picked Governor Ridge, for instance, to be his running mate, they would have threatened a floor fight at the convention, had challenged his own choice as a nominee for the vice president. That's how they operate. And I certainly saw it with a primary. Here I am trying to hold on to my seat in Rhode Island, and this is America. You're free to run in a primary, but the money that poured in from that noisy right wing, millions of dollars in a primary, no right winger is going to win a U.S. Senate seat in Rhode Island.
Right. Well, let's talk very, very quickly. You wrote a great book about a compliant Congress. The name of the book is Against the Tide, How a Compliant Congress Empowered a Reckless President. Do you think that the key to a Republican resurgence is going to be a Congress that is tougher and holds the White House and the executive more accountable in this next term?
Well, it depends on what the issues are. I think that part of Senator Obama, President-elect Obama's appeal was that post-partisanship, going back to the 90s and the Newt Gingrich and the shutdown of the government, the impeachment, all the fighting. People now, American people, want us to work together. And that's what George W. Bush originally ran on, if you remember. I'm a united, not a divider.
Yeah, so post-partisanship might be an opening for Republicans like you. Lincoln Chafee, former Republican U.S. Senator from Rhode Island, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Senator Chafee is now a distinguished fellow at Brown University's Watson Institute in Providence. And now headlines from Femi Okeh. Okay.
Thanks, John. The time is 20 minutes to the top of the hour. The markets have just opened. The Dow is down more than 170 points. A series of explosions in Baghdad today left 4 people dead and 22 injured. A car bomb went off in a busy neighborhood downtown, and then a roadside bomb blew up in North Baghdad an hour and a half later. And in the northern city of Mosul, 2 sisters were killed by unidentified gunmen as they waited outside of their house. Gay marriage is now legal in Connecticut after a judge cleared the way following last month's historic state Supreme Court decision. After a brief hearing this morning, a judge ruled that gay and lesbian couples can pick up a marriage license at town and city clerk's offices statewide. And many gay and lesbian couples are planning on ceremonies today. And the Endeavour shuttle is due to go up on Friday, but weather may put pay to that. We will keep an eye on the weather for you. Let's look at some main stories making news for you this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. John, how you feeling?
I'm feeling pretty good.
That's good, because you know it's flu season.
That's what I hear.
And sometimes when people get ill, they get on Google and they put in their symptoms, right? Because they're looking for ways to feel a little bit better. What they might not know is that Google is keeping track of those because they are helping to track the spread of influenza in the United States. They say Google says a new tool may be able to map where the flu is spreading and help provide warnings of epidemics up to 10 days earlier than existing techniques. Joining us now from Geneva is Dr. Keiji Fukuda, the coordinator for the Global Influenza Program at the World Health Organization. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Doctor, what do you think of this idea of Google injecting itself in compiling data about the flu?
Well, I think the thinking is pretty innovative, and I think that it's welcome. It tries to take advantage of a lot of the more modern means of communicating, and there's an awful lot of information which goes onto the internet. So if it works out, it could be very helpful.
Would you consider it credible information? Is it potentially misleading for a whole variety of reasons, beginning with it isn't facing any scientific review, vigorous review in any way?
Well, I think that, clearly at this point, the jury's out as to whether it actually proves to be useful. I think the potential is there, but those kinds of questions which you raised are just, are going to have to be answered. Does it really correlate not just with people's interests or curiosity about the flu, mm-hmm. but does it really correlate with, disease? Does it really give information which is above of what we already have available, and can people act on that information? I think that's not clear yet.
How would the World Health Organization potentially use this kind of information?
Well, I think that, right now there are other electronic systems which are very helpful. For example, there's a system called GFIN, which was developed by the Canadian government, which looks at news reports, and that can be a very helpful way of identifying outbreaks going on in different parts of the world. So I think with the Google system, again, it's going to be a wait and see to see whether this provides information above what's already available. And I think that really a lot of the interest may be for its applications out of countries like the U.S. The U.S. has a lot of surveillance systems, but can it be useful in places where there aren't a lot of surveillance going on?
Epidemiologically, the internet has the potential for tracking a lot of sort of broad data and already was helpful in tracking SARS, right?
Yes, the internet definitely has the potential for tracking broad data and potentially for picking up unusual events. But I think the broadness is also one of the questions. When you get information like that, you know, the next question you really have to ask is, what does it mean? Does it really reflect disease, or does it perhaps reflect concern on the part of the public because something has been raised in the media and people are worried? And you have to tease through those things.
One step at a time. Dr. K.G. Fukuda, the coordinator for the Global Influenza Program at the World Health Organization. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Fukuda came to us from Geneva.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, November 12th. Femi Okeh is here with headlines.
Hello there. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Treasury Chief Hank Paulson will update us on the $700 billion bailout plan in just over half an hour. It's been a busy week for Paulson, with pressure to give money to car makers and criticism of how funds are being doled out to banks. Elsewhere in Washington, three Senate seats still don't have winners. Races in Alaska, Minnesota, and Georgia have been recounting, and a runoff ahead. Republicans currently hold all three seats. Congressional Democrats want to pass legislation that will help out the troubled auto industry. Speaking on CBS's Early Show, Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm says the crisis is urgent.
This government decided that it was going to step in and throw $700 billion at the financial sector. We're just asking for a fraction of that.
And if the legislation is to pass, they have to get it to the White House and get the White House on board. Treasury officials turned down General Motors' request for a loan last month. And humans don't always tell the truth, and neither does it appear do crabs. Crabs sometimes tell fibs. Australian ecologists have discovered that male fiddler crabs who lose their big claw lie by growing a new one that looks really strong, but it's actually just for show. The study is unusual because it detects dishonesty in the animal kingdom, and that's very difficult to pick up.
Physiological dishonesty or mental dishonesty?
Well, I think a bit of both. I think the mental makes the physical happen.
I wonder who paid for that study.
You're just a lying fiddler crab. Women. Like all the other people in the media. Thank you, Femi. That's interesting.
Me,
that's pretty interesting. So healthcare does well during recession, they say. But will healthcare reform do well under this new administration? Joining us now for a Barack Obama briefing on healthcare is Dr. Herbert Pardes. He's president and CEO of New York Presbyterian Hospital and Healthcare System. He's held this position since 1999, has a great position to view healthcare reform as we try to add a page or two to America's briefing book for Barack Obama. Doctor, thanks so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
First of all, in times of recession, healthcare does really well as an industry. But what does that mean for people, consumers, who are going to be needing healthcare over the next 4 years?
Well, I think it's a mixed picture. In other words, people who have limited or restricted economic circumstances sometimes have to delay elective procedures. So healthcare sees a lot of activity. There are some people who have greater health problems, perhaps because of the stress related to the economic downturn. But you also will see, as I say, people who hold back on procedures that they might feel they could delay for a while.
With so much turmoil in the financial industry, and we don't want to necessarily right away get into the specifics of Barack Obama's proposed plan for health care, but do you have any confidence that the insurance industry, that that sector of the economy can actually take over any level of responsibility for health care under a federally subsidized program? Are they robust enough to be able to extend the umbrella to millions and millions of new consumers?
Well, I think they may be asked to play a part. I see the driving force here going to be the new administration, which is very much interested in healthcare reform, and trying to spread healthcare access and coverage to more and more people around the country. And they may involve the insurance industry to an extent, but also be looking at increased federal support.
Do you endorse the idea of extending the federal employee health care model nationally to all citizens?
I think that's an excellent idea. My feeling is that this country likes choice, and a plan like the federal health plan seems to work well. One might look at different populations and say what might be appropriate for different ones in trying to come out with a overall solution.
Dr. Pardis, what is it going to take for real change to be confronted, discussed, and implemented? It's no secret that there are tremendous problems with the healthcare system, and they seem to get just spoken about over and over again, and so little movement towards any kind of reform is apparent.
Well, first of all, I think what it's going to take is bipartisan collaboration. One of the biggest problems in Washington has been the tendency for the two sides to kind of draw off and not work together. I think this is a big enough and crucial enough problem, so we would be hoping that there be some way by which the two parties would decide that this is important enough to see some action on. I think there are a number of issues that are problematic in healthcare. On the other hand, there are positive aspects, too, in terms of what's happening in healthcare. So if you look at areas, take surgery, for example, one of the nice things that's happening are efforts to make surgery less invasive. As a result, require shorter stays in the hospital, often do that surgery outside the hospital. What we'd like to make sure is when you see advances like that, that we ultimately spread it to the entire population.
Well, let's talk about maybe one of the tougher sectors then, chronic care, diabetes, and obesity. What's the first thing that the federal government can do to have a real impact on the diabetes chronic care populations that are filling up emergency rooms and creating such a problem in institutions like yours?
Well, first of all, I think it's an excellent choice because I think diabetes and obesity are big problems. They both lead to all kinds of serious complications and cost the system an enormous amount. So how do you approach it? First of all, what you should do is make the care of diabetes comprehensively reimbursed. Right now, the reimbursement is such that what you can offer diabetic people is limited. Let's say you have a 16-year-old kid who's diagnosed with diabetes. He comes in and you give him a prescription for insulin and a recommended diet. That's inadequate. No 16-year-old kid that I know have ever listened to me or most parents. You need to work with them. There has to be people who focus on the nutritional side, the behavioral side, work with them in a continuing way. We started a terrific diabetes program up in New York Presbyterian some years ago, but the only way the thing makes it is with philanthropy. Otherwise, it's in deficit.
And the philanthropy is supporting the constant sort of relationship between the patient and the clinician to make sure that they are compliant and that they do the behavioral changes that are going to improve their health.
Well, I would say the philanthropy is supporting comprehensiveness and a preventive approach. I think diabetes is a wonderful candidate as a first go, if you will, at a disease which has wide implications and could be approached in a productive way.
Great recommendation. Of course, you have firsthand experience with that. Let's talk about the changes that have happened in the last 20 years. It seems certain sectors of healthcare have actually just kind of given up on the government, given up on insurance-based healthcare entirely. I speak of pediatrics in the city of New York, plastic surgery, other kinds of healthcare professionals have basically said, we're retail only. You pay us. Period. The
dermatologist.
Yeah, dermatologist, sure. Is there a way or a program that you can envision that would encourage them to come back under the umbrella, that would give them confidence that this isn't just a big pain for them to deal with, paperwork, and that actually doesn't help their practice at all?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the need to reduce paperwork and regulations. It's overwhelming and is very costly. I think that if there were a way of providing coverage potentially available to everybody, that most medical people would try to come in. You, of course, have to make the payments that you give them reasonable and viable. So I understand your point about people withdrawing from government pay. As a result, what we should be aiming toward, and that doesn't mean you can do it in a day, it may take a while to get there, is a comprehensive system which offers choices and pays providers at a reasonable level. There may be elective procedures that people want to do beyond that, and if doctors want to go there and if people want to go there, that's okay. My primary concern is the basic guts, the main issues in healthcare and medicine.
And nobody knows them better than Dr. Herbert Pardes, President and CEO of New York Presbyterian Hospital and Healthcare System. Thanks so much for contributing to America's briefing book for Barack Obama on healthcare.
So that's some advice in fixing the healthcare system. And here's a question about another bailout.
Beth Ravitch, I agree that if we're going to give this money to the auto companies, they have to agree to conditions that will make our country stronger. But I also would like to know why, when we gave the money to the insurance company, to AIG, why didn't we ask for agreements that they would insure our people who need medical coverage?
Oh, there's a thought. We want to hear your ideas on what to do about the auto industry.
This is Nick in Cliffside Park, New Jersey. Auto industry bailout? No, we need a takeover, not a bailout. That means that the condition, the string that has to be attached, is that we need to fire the top management of the auto industry and hire the newer, younger, more dynamic people who are going to give us a new generation of cars built in America that leapfrog over the Japanese. Better than the Prius, not catching up to the Prius, but better than. It's not easy, but we can do it. Yes, we can.
Yes, we can. Sounds familiar. What do you think should be done about the auto industry and all of the pain in Detroit? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
We've also been following the lobbyist feeding frenzy, trying to grab a piece of the federal treasury's bailout package. Here's your takeaway on that.
Why doesn't Circuit City reclassify itself as a bank, and then maybe they can get bailed out? Which sounds like a joke, but when you consider that General Motors and the other automakers would like to be included in the bailout package, it doesn't actually sound that far-fetched.
Yes, you too can be a bank, according to Mark Landler from our partner, The New York Times. So we're always on at The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and John's right. It's The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway,